Well, good morning. We have a full house on this beautiful day today. Some of the people who are with us this morning are here because of a program that we operate in connection with the State Bar. It's called Court with Class. So students get information about the case that is to be argued this morning. And then after the argument is concluded, Justice Gableman will come down and speak with the students, not about the merits of the case, but a little bit about how this court operates and how it takes cases. This morning we have three schools that have sent students, and we'd like to recognize them. So as I call the name of the school, if you'd all please stand, Randolph High School. We have students from Randolph? Very good. Thank you for joining us. Greendale Baptist Academy. Very good. Thank you again for joining us. And Central Wisconsin Christian School. Oh, you are a big group. Well, thank you so much for coming. We love to have you come to the Supreme Court. We like you to know how government operates and hopefully get you interested in, who knows, maybe even a career in law. Okay, so we will now begin by calling our first case, Walworth State Bank versus Abbey Springs, 140940. Are you ready to proceed, counsel? Please do. Oh, before you start, let me tell you one thing. We have had some concerns about the length of arguments. Not that they're too long or too short. We give each side 30 minutes to argue. And the counsel is very good about adhering to the 30 minutes. So the students know you start out with a green light. That tells counsel that you can begin. And then you move to a yellow light. That tells counsel that he or she has 5 minutes to go. And then a red light. And they're really supposed to stop. They can answer a question that they're in the middle of answering, but they're not supposed to continue with the argument. And counsel, there are routinely, they adhere to the lights. However, members of the court don't always adhere to the lights. And that has resulted in one side or the other getting significantly more time. It's also resulted in our inability to finish up our cases sometimes during the time that the court has allocated for them and having to go on at a later date, usually a morning argument carrying over to the afternoon. So we're going to try to be really careful ourselves with the time, and we appreciate your willingness to adhere also. Now, with that final word, please do begin.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. I'm Attorney Ed Thompson of Clare Law Offices, and I appear on behalf of the Walworth State Bank in this particular matter. We are respectfully requesting that this Court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and uphold the decision of the Circuit Court. The real issue in this case is whether a condominium association, after foreclosure, may legally enforce a policy that forbids new purchasers from using condo facilities until all the past due assessments are paid, the past due assessments of the previous condominium owner. There are three legal principles under Wisconsin foreclosure and condominium law that I believe are very important to this determination by this court. The first is that the purchaser in a foreclosure takes free and clear of any unpaid condominium associations. That's statutory. The second is that the purchaser in a foreclosure shall not have any liability for assessments because foreclosure is not a voluntary grant. And again, that's statutory. And finally, no bylaw restriction whatsoever can render title unmarketable or otherwise affect that title. So those are the three principles, and they are statutory.
Can you give me the statute that you're referring to for each of those three principles?
Yes, Justice Bradley. For the purchaser in a foreclosure takes free and clear of any unpaid condo assessments, that's 703.165 paren 5, close paren. The second important statute and principle, and perhaps the most important, is that the purchaser in a foreclosure shall not have any liability for assessment, not any liability. And that's under 703.165 sub 2. And that's because foreclosure is not a voluntary grant. And the final one with regard to rendering title, bylaws rendering title unmarketable or otherwise affecting title, is 703.10 sub 6. Thank you. This particular case is not a mere restriction on use. It is a condominium association attempting to compel the new owner of the condominium owner of the condominium unit to pay the previous owner's past due condominium assessments after foreclosure and, most importantly, after the condominium's association's rights were extinguished.
Counselor, in the materials that I've read, there was an amount of about, a little better than $5,000 that Abby Springs talked about initially, $5,162 I wrote down, as delinquent fees. But the amount that is at issue here is $13,225. Are they for two different kinds of assessments, or is one an earlier assessment of a later accumulation?
One is an earlier assessment of the later accumulation, and that's the amount. The $5,000 amount is the amount that the association actually filed a claim for assessments, lien, with the Clerk of Courts of Walworth County.
So it's to use the water facilities, the recreational facilities, too. So they're not for two different kinds of assessments.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
That's correct.
Now, the $13,000 relates to what the bank had to pay in order to get the sale completed, right?
Yes.
And it paid it under protest.
Yes, okay. Indeed.
And when did the $5,000 accumulate?
The $5,000 was a condominium association lien, claim for lien, for past due assessments that was filed against Mr. Pankratz, the previous owner of the unit. So those accrued well before the foreclosure action was even
part
commenced.
Part of the $13,000 then?
So the total then comes up to $13,000.
So the 5 is part of the 13. It's not an additional 5.
It is not an additional 5.
You keep referring to it as a lien, but I didn't see any statute that said the assessment is a lien.
I believe that when the condominium association, in fact, files a claim for past due assessments, that it becomes a lien on the property. That's why we name the condominium association.
Where does it file it?
At the clerk of court's office. In county clerk, where the property is located.
So it just files, you now owe me $13,000, and you view that as a lien, regardless of the fact that it's not, there's no court order that it's a lien.
That's correct.
It's a self-designated, self-imposed lien.
Yes, and when you order a title commitment, when you go to sell the property or to foreclose upon, that comes up as an exception to title.
Because they don't want to declare title free of this $13,000, right?
Yes, whether it's the $5,000 initially or the $13,000 at the end, yes, Justice.
It's 13 because the amounts continue to accumulate, right? Okay.
During the foreclosure process, there's a monthly fee against the condominium units at Abbey Springs that keep accumulating.
And just to clarify, when you said clerk of courts, did you really mean that, or did you mean the county clerk or the register?
My understanding is that the condo liens are filed in the clerk of court's office.
Okay.
Up your county, where the property is located.
All right. Thank you.
Could I ask, in this elaborate transaction, were any taxes owed on the property that the Pankratzes had?
Yes, Justice.
And who paid those taxes?
The bank, Walworth State Bank did.
Why did they pay it?
Because by statute, the taxes are have to be paid by the bank.
Okay.
But that's contrary to these association liens.
Okay, but I thought your first principle was that any purchaser was acquiring property free and clear. That apparently is not true.
If you heard that, Justice, I misled you then. Free and clear of the condominium assessments, the past due condominium assessments from, in this case, Mr. Pankratz. So the purchaser, whether it's the bank or a third party at a sheriff's sale, under 703-165, paren 5, takes the property free and clear of those past due condominium assessments.
Okay. Did the bank lose money in this case?
Oh, absolutely, yes, Your Honor.
Well, then, could you explain that? In, I think it was 1996, the original owners of the property borrowed money from the bank.
Yes.
Okay. Does the record show how much money they borrowed?
I'm sure it does. I don't recall the number, Your Honor.
Did these original owners pay from 1996 to 2011 or 12 or whenever it was?
There were some payments until they went into default, yes.
And the Christensens paid almost $500,000 for the property?
Yes.
But you're saying that there's a big gap between the amount of money that was lent in 1996 and almost $500,000 that was paid.
Yes, by the time the cost of the foreclosure and the cost of the sale, yes, the bank lost money, but it did not ask for a deficiency judgment in this matter in order to get the shortened redemption period that's allowed under foreclosure statutes.
Okay. Are the actual figures all in this record?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Now, the lien that you keep talking about, which is filed in the Clerk of Circuit Court, is under 703.165, subsection 3. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So that's another statute that's involved here.
Perhaps another statute that's involved is subsection 1, which talks about how condominium associations enforce their lien. And enforcing it against a foreclosing bank or a third-party purchaser thereafter is not one of those alternatives. They obviously can collect against the unit owner, Mr. Pankratz, while he's a unit owner or thereafter.
Well, it says assess. In this section, assessment means regular and special assessments for common expenses and charges, fines, or assessments against specific units for damages to the condo, or for penalties. Well, why do you think this fits under one? Because the argument here seems to be that this is not a common expense and charge, because this is not a common property, but that these are, now I'll use the word special, but I don't know what that means in the statute, that these are assessments that are charged if I want to use facilities. Now, if I don't want to use any of the water facilities, if I don't want to use the golf facilities, if I don't want to use the restaurant facilities, I just want to live in my condo unit and I don't want to be bothered by anyone else or anything else. So I don't want to pay any of these assessments. Why do they fit under 703-165?
Specifically because in this condominium declaration, these recreational amenities are really treated like common elements, even though they're held in a separate condominium, because the declaration provides that you cannot, as a unit owner, walk away from those responsibilities. You get to use those things, and if there's any expenses involved with those things, then you will pay those expenses. You can't sever your ownership of those recreational amenities.
Yeah, but doesn't my fee for golfing depend on how many in the family golf and how often and on what days maybe?
There perhaps are additional fees that are incurred that on top of these monthly assessments. But when you get an assessment every month for your condominium unit, it is for everything. There's no breakdown. There's nothing to say, well, you golfed six times, so you owe us more money, or you didn't golf, so you don't owe us any money.
There's a base assessment that regardless of whether I use a PIA for the boat or not, I have to pay.
Yes, by owning the condominium unit.
And is that the $13,000?
It is.
The argument is advanced that the declaration of the condominium unit, unit number one, makes no reference to this being a common area, the recreational facilities. Your opposing counsel asserts that. Are you asserting that the declaration does make reference to the recreational facilities as common areas?
Yes, I think when you look at the declaration for, this is a big condominium, and it's made up of several condominium associations. There's one association, but there are different condominiums.
And each condominium, each of the 15, has its own declaration, right?
That's correct, yes. And they're all intertwined. There's a commonality between all of them. This is not unusual in a big condominium. Geneva National, another big condominium in our jurisdiction. The roads are in one condominium. The golf courses are in another. But there's this commonality between them, and saying that if you're a unit owner, you can use the roads and you can use the recreational facilities.
How does that work? I don't remember the exact year. Perhaps it was 2011. But 99.99%, as I understand it, of the recreational facilities are in the declaration page of Condo Unit 15. And, of course, Condo Unit 1, which is the one we're talking about, precedes it by, I don't know, a couple of decades, maybe. I might be off on that, but it seemed like quite a time, maybe 20 years, maybe less than that. So I return to my question, where in the declaration of unit number one, what year was that? Do you recall offhand? I just don't. When unit one came into effect, it was the first one built. Was it in the 70s?
I think it was in the 70s.
Yeah, why I say decades before unit 15. Where in the declaration do you have reference that supports the recreational facilities being common area?
I think it's in the bylaws. And the bylaws state that unit owners and their families and guests may use the recreational facilities for the intended purposes. I think that's in Article 5.
So it's in the bylaws, not in the declaration.
Correct.
That's what I understood, too. The second area, unless someone wants to jump in, your second principle, and this is something I think that is a real focus of the dispute here, and that is the interpretation of 703.165(2). And the second sentence in 703.165(2) indicates, and it starts, in a voluntary grant, the grantee shall be jointly and severally liable, etc. I want to make sure that you have time to bring that in front of you, so let me give you that time, unless you don't have it.
Thank you.
Right now.
Well, I think that is one of the critical differences,
yes,
in this particular case, is that when you sell a condominium unit, Mr. Pankratz, and that's who the former...
Before you get to the argument, I want to stay on the words of the statute, because I always start with the words of the statute. What do they mean? Let me get to the essence of my concern. Your argument advances that this statute addresses what happens in an involuntary grant. Court of Appeals says not so. It only deals with a voluntary grant. That's what the words say. This doesn't apply. Your argument really rests on the premise that 703.165(2) does deal with involuntary grants. What language do you point to, or how do you interpret the existing language to advance your argument that this sub 2 deals with involuntary grants?
Thank you for the opportunity. First of all, if we're going to rely upon what the law says voluntary grants. It could have just said grants.
Or it could have said involuntary grants. I think a predecessor statute made reference to something like that.
Right. And it specifically did not. It specifically says it applies only when there's a voluntary grant. So therefore, on the inverse, it doesn't apply when there's an involuntary. In addition, under subsection 5 of that same statute, it indicates that our lien, our bank's first mortgage lien, has priority over these past any liens or these past due assessments. And I think the law has been clear that a bank, when it forecloses, does not have liability for these past due assessments. The language could have said voluntary and involuntary. It could have been silent and just said grant, and that would put us in a real bad predicament in making this argument, but it doesn't. The statute specifically says at the time of a voluntary grant, the successor is jointly and severally liable.
And you interpret that then inversely. That's what I heard you just say. Is that correct?
I do, yes.
Now, paragraph 3 of the Court of Appeals decision, it says, for fees that are separate in addition to the condo assessments, Abbey offers its members access to recreational facilities. The declaration provides that title to the recreational facilities has been conveyed and is vested in the association, and that recreational facilities shall not be part of the common areas and facilities. And then it refers to 1 to 13. Then it says condo 15 was formed and recreational facilities was added to the common areas of that condo. And then goes on. Are there any facts that are wrong in that paragraph or anywhere in the Court of Appeals opinion?
The Court of Appeals did not talk about the bylaws of in this particular matter that indicated that, number one, that all unit owners within Abbey Springs and their families may use the recreational facilities for the intended purposes. Number two, in the event there was any damage to those recreational facilities, all unit owners, by accepting their deed, are deemed to have authorized repairs undertaken by the board. Now, this is Article 5, Section 6N, as in Nancy, and also Article 5, Section 3A, as in Ann. In addition, the bylaws provide that repairs above a certain amount require a majority of authorized votes of all unit owners. That would include the unit that the bank owned through foreclosure, and that's under Article 5, Section 3C, as in cat. So this all throughout the bylaws. Again, are they common elements? No, they're not common elements. Are they treated like common elements? Yes, they are. Every unit owner, by accepting their deed within Abbey Springs, accepting that deed with the recreational facilities and authorizes repairs to be made.
So your argument turns on the fact that in the declaration, they're not common elements, and they're not defined as common elements, but they're treated as common elements, so you therefore say they are common elements.
Justice, my red light.
That's your argument?
My red light, ma'am. May I answer
that? Well, it's orange.
I think that we've had some light problems over here, so you still have time.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes, my argument is they are common amenities offered to everybody who owns a condominium unit at Abbey Springs.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Counsel, I want to get back to the common area and the recreational facilities and the declaration page. You've indicated it's not in the declaration page, but there's reference in the bylaws. Yet 703.10 sub 6 says title to a condominium unit is not rendered unmarketable or otherwise affected by any provision of the bylaws or by reason of any failure of the bylaws to comply. comply with the provision of this chapter. I think it's the position of those opposing your position that instruments such as bylaws have no impact on title, whether recorded or not recorded.
Well, if that's the position, in fact, in this case, it did have an effect. It had a dramatic effect. When the title company issued the title commitment, there was an exception for these dues and assessments, these past dues and assessments. Equally as important, and I think it's further evidence of what the Condominium Association believes in this matter, it issued a payoff letter when we tried to sell that unit to a third party. And that payoff letter said, if the Walworth State Bank pays that full $13,000, which included the past due assessments, then you will get over this interest or lien in the property because of past due assessments. And that's what the title company required. And when we couldn't get that, then this buyer of the property from us said, we're walking, we're not buying, and we're going to sue you for specific performance.
Well, help me with this, then. Sub 6, which I just read, that says title is not titled to a condominium unit, is not rendered unmarketable, or otherwise affected by any provisions of bylaws. And that's what the law is, but you're saying, but it is affected. Title is affected by the bylaws. So how do you square that argument with the legal principles set forth in sub 6?
I square it in that, in fact, it occurs, and it occurred in this particular case. Title was affected.
Well, it seems to be you're saying kind of from your argument, as a matter of fact, it was affected. But it seems to me that this statute says, as a matter of law, it cannot be affected by bylaws. So maybe I'm reading that statute incorrectly. Let me ask, does this statute, as you interpret it, say that, let me give you a chance to get it in front of you. Do you have it? Title to a condominium unit, now I'm kind of skipping and paraphrasing, is not rendered unmarketable or otherwise affected by any provision of the bylaws. So you're saying, as a matter of fact, it was, but it seems like this is saying, as a matter of law, we do not consider it to be, unless you interpret that statute differently. And that's what I'm asking for your help with.
The red light has come on, May. Finish. Thank you. I believe that subsection indicates that you can't have a bylaw that will affect title. And this bylaw, or it's not even a bylaw, this policy clearly did affect title in violation of that particular subsection. That's separate from our argument with regard to the fact that a third-party purchaser or foreclosure has no liability under the other subsection, no liability for past due assessments, but indeed, we do have liability.
What does unmarketable mean there? It doesn't mean you have a hard time selling it. I mean, that when you talk about unmarketable title, it has a definite meaning in sub 6.
Again, the red light, but other than that, yes, it does. It says, does not rendered unmarketable or otherwise affected.
Which is broader than unmarketable.
Yes.
Which means the bylaw fails, not only because it's not marketable, because it has affected marketability, but because it affected it any other way. So it looks as if the bylaws can't do very much here and be effective.
That's how
I read 6.
In this particular case, because it deals with past due assessments, that's correct.
Thank you very
much. But that's all you're dealing with in this case, past assessments.
Yes.
I have another question, and that is that in the prior statute, this was revised, right? this whole statute was revised. In the prior statute, I thought there was a provision that said, with a holder of a first mortgage, and that's the bank here, obtains title of the unit, which the bank here did, as a result of foreclosure of the first mortgage, which you did, such acquirer of title, which is the bank, is, or its successors and assigns, shall not be liable for the share of common expenses or assessments, and it goes on to use that same language. Is that legislative history for you, against you, or irrelevant?
Oh, I think it's definitely for me, as is the practice of foreclosure and condominium law over the past 20 years. It's definitely for me.
I didn't see it cited in any of the briefs. Maybe I just missed it.
I don't think it is cited.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Ladies and gentlemen, may it please the court. I am David C. Williams of Harrison Williams and McDonald, and I'm here representing Abbey Springs, Inc., which was formed by a merger with Abbey Springs Condominium Association, Inc. Our position is pretty thoroughly stated in the Court of Appeals decision. As a matter of fact, if they had allowed me to write the decision myself, I couldn't have done a better job as far as stating my position goes. Now, I will, however, pick up from some of the questions the justice has had, as well as the comments of my distinguished opponent.
Before you pick up, let's stay with that Court of Appeals decision that you seem to be enthusiastically embracing. In the Court of Appeals opinion, one of the paragraphs contained language, something like, there's no evidence that title was affected. Let me see if I can be more precise and find it quickly. It says there's no evidence that title was affected, I think is essentially what it says. I hope that I have that right. At any rate, it seems to me that maybe there is evidence here. Didn't you have a title insurer that wasn't willing to waive the exception? Isn't that evidence? Didn't the Court of Appeals get that wrong?
Well, no, because although there was an affidavit by Chicago Title Company, one of their agents, as I pointed out to the trial court and ever since, is there's no evidence they were ever given my letter in which I unequivocally stated.
What letter? Be specific, because you have a few.
I wrote two letters, one to Attorney Thompson, who was then representing the bank, on behalf of Abbey Springs, Inc., and it was prior to the time that the bank sold the property at foreclosure sale. In that letter, I said, I suggest that you announce at the sale by the sheriff our rule, which states that if, in fact, assessments are not paid, you can't use the recreational facilities, and that applies, as I explained to him, even after a foreclosure sale.
That's the January 23rd, 2013 letter.
That's correct. And our purpose for that wasn't exactly benign. It wasn't a threat either. In fact, the reason we do that is it's in my client's interest to get the sale through and to get a new buyer entitled as soon as possible. And at that point in time, we can then have our lien, such as it exists under the statutes. Now, if some uninformed buyer comes in at a foreclosure sale and doesn't realize that, doesn't do proper investigation, and they decide, and then they discover after the fact, well, I got to pay up in order to use these facilities. Then it delays it. They may have to sell it again at foreclosure sale. It's up to the judge to decide whether or not they should have informed themselves beforehand, whether or not they forfeit their deposit, which is 10% usually in Walworth County. So it was in our interest to let any purchaser know of our rule. Secondly, when the issue of the Christensens came up as purchasers, I specifically wrote a letter again to Mr. Thompson unequivocally stating that the bank is not liable to pay these assessments. The bank's purchaser is not liable to pay these assessments. However, we are going to enforce our rule.
Counselor, given the priority of a first mortgage and a lien for assessments due a condominium association, isn't the first mortgage prior?
Yes. And
okay. So and the first mortgage is prior. At a foreclosure sale, isn't the rule of law that the sale forecloses any interest that isn't accepted from that first priority? I know taxes are one of the exceptions, and that's why the bank had to pay them. But I didn't see an exception for the fees you're talking about, so I don't know why you weren't foreclosed when the judgment was entered, unless your fees are prior to the bank's, and you tell me, no, the bank's lien is prior.
It's our lien that is foreclosed.
Okay, your lien is foreclosed, but you think you can still keep the dollars that underlie the lien in place?
No. As I stated clearly in my letters to Mr. Thompson, you don't have to pay these fees. Your purchaser doesn't have to pay these fees. But if you do, if you don't, we're going to enforce our rule.
And your
our rule is if there are unpaid fees, you can't use the recreational facilities. Now, that rule was not passed. The suggestion is this was a clever way to try to get paid. But if you look at the rule itself, which is in the record, the rule doesn't even mention foreclosure sales. The rule states that any unit that is behind on payment of assessments, more than 90 days delinquent is the word, automatically is prohibited from using the recreational facilities. Not the entire lakefront, but the specific facilities that are owned and operated by the association. That rule is applied normally when people get behind. It's not applied just in the foreclosure context. And the reason it states it applies to a unit and not to an individual is we couldn't very well enforce the rule if it could be evaded simply by, for example, a person entitled, rather than pay his back assessments, he conveys to a trust of some sort and says, well, there's a new owner now. The rule doesn't apply to the new owner. So rather than, or in order to avoid having to try to figure out, well, does he really own the trust? Trusts are very common for Illinois residents, which are most of the people who use our facilities and own units there. So
if I buy your argument, yeah, just so I'm sure I understand it, if I buy your argument and someone has a judgment lien against the person that owns this property, so that's docketed against the property, the judgment lien is docketed after the first mortgage, but the foreclosure would get rid of the lien, but then the judgment creditor can come back and collect because the foreclosure doesn't get rid of the dollar amount on which the lien is based?
Well, the dollar amount was against the Pancrases.
Well, the dollar amount is generally names the person, but you recorded against a person's property with the hope that when the property is sold, you're going to get paid. So if I buy your argument, then people who are judgment creditors would have the lien foreclosed, so they don't necessarily get paid, but they could still go back and collect against the person who incurred the debt. Is that right?
Well, we never actually, I don't believe we ever obtained a judgment against the Pancrases. The bank may have. What the record shows is that, contrary to a statement in a brief, that when the Pancrases got behind several years before the foreclosure, we took away their boat storage privileges, even though he claimed to be a high-end Chicago attorney, he was going to sue us and everything. But once we took away his boat storage privileges, he paid up.
Okay, well, I I'm just trying to be sure I really understand your argument. So in my example, the lien goes away for the judgment creditor, but you could still go after the debtor who owes the money from which the judgment arose. But here, you're not going after the Pancrases who incurred the debt. You're really going after the property, right? I mean, you could still go after them. You're telling me the lien goes away, but your debt wasn't your debt against the owner, the people that incurred the dollar amount on which the lien was based?
I mean, the Pancrases.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
So you could go after them and try to collect from them, right?
Yes.
Okay. But that's not what you're doing here. You're trying to collect out of the property, right?
We don't care if they pay or not. As we explained, we have a lot more demand for our facilities than we can fulfill. So whether or not a particular purchaser wants to pay off a debt that is owed by a prior owner or not, we don't really care. But if, in fact, they want to use the facilities, we have not made an exception for those people.
But your debt that you're trying to collect, you are levying it against the property. I mean, you could go and sue the Pancrases if we treated them just like the judgment creditor who lost his lien. You lost your lien. You could go sue them. But that's not what you're doing. You're levying against use of the property. And that's what I'm having trouble understanding.
We're enforcing the same rule we enforce against anybody who's more than 90 days delinquent, regardless of whether or not they go through foreclosure.
But you can always enforce it against the Pancrases, just like the judgment creditor. Go sue them in Chicago or wherever you want to sue them. But that's not the dispute that's before us. The dispute is because you're trying to enforce it against use of the property that they don't own anymore. So you're treating this property different than you've treated other property where you say you've restricted the use against the owner. The people that caused the debt here aren't the owners anymore.
I'd understand your argument a little more if the new people started fresh and they decided not to pay and each month incurred the $500 debt or
right.
something like that.
That would be the
then
same as the
payment. The penalty against them would be levied against them for their non-payment of the amounts due if they want to use those facilities. But I think what Chief Justice Rogenczak's trying to convey is you're bootstrapping the debt that the prior owner had and still owes you, presumably, onto the new owner's, making it the new owner's obligation such that it impairs their use of the property for actions they never took.
Well, first of all, they have no right to use the property.
That's assuming they bought the property subject to that debt being paid. Where does it indicate that they bought the property subject to their obligation to pay
that debt of the prior owner?
The property subject to the rules and regulations, the declaration, the bylaws of the association. Now, Mr. Thompson quoted the parts of the bylaws that state, well, his interpretation is it's, these are facilities anyone can use. But the bylaws also say that you don't have the right to use them if your unit is behind on assessments.
Except I thought I understand your answer to Justice Bradley, or someone's answer to Justice Bradley earlier, that, and when I looked through the record, this membership policy wasn't in effect until sometime, I think, January 29, 2013?
No, it was.
Or when was it?
According to the...
When did the membership guest policy exist? Because they bought this, Pancrax's bought this in 96, and this policy didn't exist then, right?
No, the executive director, who has the only evidence on the subject, his affidavit states it went into effect at least as far back as 1986, 10 years before the time that the bank even made its mortgage. However, it was a policy back in 1986, but was put in the form of a written rule in 2011 before this dispute arose, several years before. And as further up, I make note that the bylaws also state that it's not only the power but the duty of the board to adopt policies and rules in respect to use of the recreational facilities. So anyone reading the declaration or bylaws would realize that there are rules and regulations in respect to the recreational facilities that you have to examine, and that's where we get into the Apple Valley case.
Yeah, but let me, I won't ask okay. After this, because I think some of my colleagues want to ask you some questions, but if you're really going down the road of they could have read this and knew this is what their obligation was, then how do you get the $13,000 debt to begin with, because those rules and regulations and bylaws and declaration didn't reference that amount that would be due and owing back when the Pancrazes bought the property in 96?
I guess I missed that. It was a little...
If you're saying the Christensens bought this knowing that their obligation was to pay this off because they just have to read the bylaws, right?
Well, what we're saying is if you look at the whole statutory structure, what is the protection for the Christensens, and the only protection they have is under section 703.33. And under that section, the seller has to provide the buyer with a copy of certain documents. And included in that is specifically the rules and regulations of the association. The buyer or potential buyer then has 5 business days to decide they don't like them and back out of it without giving any reason. That's the buyer's protection. Now, in this particular case, we don't know, and I did question the buyer's attorney about whether they ever got these from the bank or not, or read them, and he didn't know. But that's the buyer's protection, and that obligation goes up through closing, actually. It doesn't go away unless you go ahead and close without following up on that. So in this particular case, that was their protection. They could back out and either renegotiate or just decide to buy some other unit or some other condominium. So when you look at the whole statutory scheme, which is what was construed in Apple Valley, that's the buyer's protection. And what's important to this case is in Apple Valley, they said not only the buyer, but a lender on a condominium unit is obligated under our statutory scheme to examine those documents and be knowledgeable of them. And the court said that only 9 years ago.
Is it your position that the assessment attaches to the unit and not the owner? For these outstanding fees.
It attaches to the unit, but not after foreclosure. So, yeah, at the time, it attaches to a unit, but it's after foreclosure, we don't have a lien anymore.
But the fees arose prior to foreclosure, correct?
And during the foreclosure.
And the association's interest in these outstanding amounts arises from the recreational usage policy.
Yes.
And do you agree that the judgment of foreclosure not only foreclosed the lien, but also any interest in the mortgage premises?
Yes, any interest in the premises, yes.
Thank you.
But... Again, subject to the restrictions, because if we skip it, so there's really no argument about the first two, the statutes that Mr. Thompson mentioned, because we conceded our lien was wiped out. Now, when we get to his third point about marketability, in this case, marketability is defined in the offer to purchase. And what it says is marketability, for purposes of that transaction, consists of getting a condominium deed or a warranty deed stating the property's free and clear of all liens and encumbrances except, and among the exceptions is the rules and regulations of the condominium association, and any amendments thereto. So marketable title for purposes of this transaction means you take the property subject to the rules and regulations.
Right. And counsel, it seems to me the association's argument is almost too clever by half. And what I mean by that more specifically is that it seems to me the association is arguing semantics. You're saying...
Is arguing what? I didn't hear that.
Semantics. It seems to me it's taking the position that, well, we recognize that the lien ends at the conclusion of the foreclosure process. But how? And this is what I'm asking you without running to the definitions of lien. How is this not, in fact, joint and several liability for debts incurred by a previous owner?
Because we...
Don't say you're not enforcing the lien. Try not to use that phrase. I understand that's your argument.
My argument is what?
I'll just listen. Go ahead.
Because, as I clearly stated in letters, you don't have to pay it. The bank doesn't have to pay it.
Of course not, unless they want to use the facilities which a new purchaser would be entitled to use in the normal course of events.
His entitlement to, well, in the normal course of events, again, you...
How is this not joint and several liability? That's my question. And I think that's why some of my colleagues have been asking some of the questions they have, because we're, at least for, to my eye, I'm trying to pierce this sort of semantic veil that's being put up and trying to get to the question at hand, which is exactly as I've said, how is this not in fact joint and several liability for the debts of a previous owner?
I don't know how much clearer that could say than in the letters in the file.
Okay, you take a try.
You don't have to pay it.
Fair enough.
Okay? And the long and the short of it is The only way you can rule or overturn the Court of Appeals decision is if you overturn your decision in Apple Valley, which made a distinction between restrictions. In that particular case, as you recall, the court made a distinction between restrictions and liens.
I know that Justice Prosser has a question after I do, but I want to follow up. You've expressed unreserved appreciation for the Court of Appeals' opinion. Oh, you said you couldn't have written it better yourself.
Correct.
Page 9. The delinquent assessments, the purchasers were under no obligation to pay. This is your whole argument, it seems to me. Purchasers were under no obligation to pay the delinquent assessments and were free to utilize other recreational facilities in the area, same as everybody else, whether they owned a condo or not, I suppose. The policy merely created a pay-to-play requirement and did not attempt to create joint and several liability in any respect. Now, that, I am having a hard time with that, counsel. Maybe you can help me out there.
Well, let me going back to some of the earlier discussions, there's a statement made, there's a question raised, how much of the assessment was a result of the recreational facilities? There is no evidence that any part of the assessment arose from operation of the recreational facilities.
Your opposing counsel told us that it's all undifferentiated, that it's all included in one bill. Is he wrong?
Well, there's nothing in the record about that. And
okay.
The only thing...
Then there's nothing to indicate he's wrong.
Here's what the record indicates. The record indicates...
did you take a promise to yourself you would not answer a question yes or no in this room?
Let me interject.
Let him finish,
Justice Prosser's been waiting.
I would ask that you let him finish, Justice
Prosser.
Well, Bradley,
I just don't
Chief
want...
Chief Justice Robinson.
Okay, I don't want him badgering.
Okay, he's but, not... He's,
well,
let's...
He seems more than capable of handling it. Thanks,
right,
Justice
you
Bradley.
Know,
could you repeat the question, please?
Yes.
Well, the question is simply, is he wrong? There's nothing to indicate that it's an undifferentiated bill. Now, you're going to say there's nothing in the record, and then we're all going to draw whatever inferences we want from your answer. So go ahead.
Yes, he's wrong.
Okay.
Okay. All right. I want to have Justice Prosser. He's been waiting to ask a question. Justice Prosser?
I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, but if I bought a condo at Abbey Springs, would my assessment, my automatic assessment, entitle me to use all the recreational facilities?
No.
So I would be able to say, I don't want to use the yacht club, I don't want to use the golf course, and I don't want to be assessed for any of that.
No. The bylaws, as Mr. Thompson points out, require you to do that.
Require that you pay?
If there's a deficit or capital.
No, let's irrespective of the deficit.
Yes.
What I'm interested in, it seems to me, I'm drawing the conclusion, you tell me if I'm wrong, that the Christensen would have to pay a full assessment, including an assessment related to all the recreational facilities. So, if they didn't, under your rules, if somebody didn't go back and pay the delinquency in assessments, they'd be paying a full assessment that would entitle them to use all of these things, except they couldn't use them. Am I wrong?
Well, again, there's no evidence any assessment is made for the recreational facilities. Now, it's not, as pointed out by the Court of Appeals, it's by opponents' burden of proof on that issue, not mine. There is no evidence that any amount is paid by assessments for the recreational facilities, which is a point raised earlier. The only evidence is from the executive director of the association, who says these aren't free. We charge market prices, and use exactly those words. We charge market prices for the recreational facilities. They're not free. We charge about average, I believe he says, for those. So you're asking a question which isn't in the record, and I don't know the answer to. Do they run a deficit? The assumption seems to be, yes, they do, so they're paying for the recreational facilities. But for all the record shows and for all I personally know, they could be operating at a profit.
Counselor, is there one monthly assessment against each condominium unit, or are there several that are broken down by component parts? Do you have a $500 a month you have to pay as your condominium assessment, or is there a $100 condominium assessment and a $400 recreational assessment?
I believe there's only
one
assessment.
Okay.
But I don't know how it's labeled.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I have a question and a comment. You no longer claim a lien.
May I say my red light's on? But
yes, you certainly can answer.
That's why she's asking.
And then, yeah, that just stimulates me.
Yes.
That's not an issue anymore in this case.
Pardon me?
The issue in this case is not whether you have a valid lien. You agree you don't?
I agree.
Okay.
Right.
The issue in this case, as I understand it from the Court of Appeals and from oral argument, is whether your policy violates the statutes. And as I understand it, the policy we're talking about here is the policy that you cannot use the recreational facilities unless your unit is fully paid regarding recreational facility charges. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So the question then is, if the new owner of a unit cannot use the facilities unless the new owner pays all the back amounts due, right? Does that violate the statute? It's a very narrow question, right?
I agree that's what it comes down to.
But that's as the Court of Appeals defines the question before us. And do you think that's the question before us? All right. And your position is there's no statute that prohibits that.
Correct.
And the position of the other side is that one of these three statutes does prohibit this kind of policy.
I think that their position,
you don't agree with it.
I don't agree with their position. I think their position is that you're trying to find a way around the statutes, and you shouldn't be allowed to do it, but they can't rely on any statute for that. And
there's no statute says that policy is bad, per se. You'd have to read it through that any of the statutes.
Correct. And you know, I would also, before I end, I'd like to refer to the Wisconsin Condominium Law Handbook, which you rely on from time to time as an authority, and it points out in Section 5.36 that there are reasons for recreational facilities not to be part of the common element, and they state two reasons for that. And one is that by not making it part of the common elements, you protect the unit owners from personal liability if there's an accident or something on the recreational facilities. And that, in turn, refers to Section 703.25, Parens 3.
703.25,
sub 3.
Right.
Which states if there's a judgment against the association, they can obtain a judgment against each unit in proportion to their liability for the common expenses. The other reason they list there for holding recreational facilities not part of the common element is they say this means that if you mortgage the facilities, the mortgage and the note doesn't have to be executed by each and every member of the association, and there are 584 such members in our association, and to require or obtain all their signatures would be a near impossibility. If they're owned by the association, then simply the officers of the association can sign like any other corporation.
Thank you, Counselor.
So unless there are any questions, I've used
I think that meant sit down.
Mm-hmm.
That meant please have a seat.
Rebuttal, please.
Thank you very much. The statute that we rely upon, 703-165, paren 2, says the purchaser in a foreclosure, and this is a foreclosure sale, not a usual sale, the purchaser in a foreclosure shall have no liability for assessments because the foreclosure is not a voluntary grant. No liability. The condo's policy that's being enforced here is specifically tied to the payment of those past due assessments by the previous owner, Mr. Pankratz, who they can take a judgment against, who they can collect against. The judgment of foreclosure in this particular matter did specifically bar and foreclose, quote, any right, title, interest, and the lien, unquote, that the condominium association had. Not only the lien, but any interest they had in these previous assessments. When we, the bank, went to the sheriff's sale and bought the property, we were to be free of those past due assessments that the Pankratzes owned. But we weren't. After the judgment, but before the sheriff's sale, it was announced that there was this policy. The policy is you, bank, in a foreclosure action, are responsible to pay these past due assessments. If you want to use the recreational amenities that are provided to everybody else who owns the condo.
I understand your opposing counsel's argument that does not constitute a lien, and so therefore is not violative of the statute.
It is not a lien. I believe that the policy is illegal. It's definitely not a lien because the lien was extinguished. But so was any right or interest in that property, including these past due assessments.
I infer from your response to that you're saying it might not be a lien in law, however, it is a lien in fact.
Yes, yes, Justice.
All right.
Absolutely.
You know, you can have mortgaged property and give up your collateral, right, your security in the property, and still owe the money.
Yes, Justice.
Okay. So why not here? There's no lien on the property because that's gone, but there's still a debt owed by the owner of the property, right?
The prior owner, yes.
Right. So why? What's the matter with the the condominium saying, "Hey, welcome to the condo. We're glad to have you. But if you want to use our facilities, you got to make full payment, past and present." Where in the statute does it say That's not okay.
I think it says that in the statute, Justice, with regard to 703-165, paren 2, liability for assessments. And it says that in voluntary grants, there's joint and several liability, but not in involuntary grants.
No, okay, but if the statute is silent, you're trying to say because it's silent, it has to be the converse of the statute. Because if it's voluntary, you're liable. If it's involuntary, you must be not liable because the statute doesn't give it. I mean, you're saying if the statute doesn't directly cover it, you win.
Well, I think the statute combined with subsection 2 and subsection 5 indeed does. Subsection 2 talks about that the priority of the lien, my bank has a priority of all sums that do. And when you take that with subsection 2, which doesn't say involuntary, it says voluntary grant, I believe you can read that statute to indicate that in involuntary grants, these special assessments.
Who deals with liability, personal liability? Who has to pay, right?
Yes.
5 talks about a lien. A lien under this section is prior to all other liens except we're off the lien bit now. No one's claiming a lien here, right? I mean, that's my understanding. If they are, this opinion doesn't, from the Court of Appeals, doesn't address liens. It addresses only, is the policy of requiring the new owner to pay everything before they use the recreational facilities, does that policy violate the statute? Isn't that the limited issue that's facing this court?
It is a play on words, Justice.
But you know what? The whole law is a play on words. The whole thing that we're doing is semantic as to what the statute means and the use of words, right?
And that's why we come to this.
That's
this
right.
Theme. I suppose you'd use the words joint and several liability. Counsel.
Yes. So the lien is gone and extinguished, and yet they're still enforcing and making my bank, at a foreclosure, involuntary transfer, pay for those past due assessments of Mr. Pankratz.
And now you want the money back.
Yes.
You paid it under protest. You paid it in order to get the deal closed so that you got a buyer and you got your money, some or all of your money out, right? But you're saying you paid, you didn't get $13,000 out that you should have gotten out, right?
I'm saying that if condominium associations throughout the state of Wisconsin can have these types of policies that they adopt.
Do they? Is this typical?
Typical for Abbey Springs. I don't know if it's typical for all condominiums. But this isn't the only case in Abbey Springs. And I'm saying that if this court allows that type of policy to be, then I'll be advising all condominiums to be changing their bylaws and rules, and they'll be able to get around the statutes with regard to foreclosures and condominiums, which is exactly what has happened in fact in this particular case.
And you're going to do that because that's going to be a condition of your giving a mortgage.
I think banks will be very slow to give mortgages to condominium unit purchasers in the future if they can't tell what is going to be my equity, what will be my liability in this particular matter if the purchaser does not pay the bank back on the note. Yes. I would respectfully request that this court overturn the Court of Appeals, uphold the Circuit Court, and I really do thank you for giving me personally and my client the opportunity to appear here this morning. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Justice Gableman is going to come out now that our arguments here are concluded and speak with the students for a few minutes. And given that usually takes about 15 minutes or so, the court will meet in closed conference at 25 minutes to 11. We are adjourned. Thank you.